listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment, and each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal well-being and what's going on in our world, what's going on with food, water, air, and earth, what's going on in our communities, what's going on in our society, what's going on with our climate. And each week on Connect the Dots, we talk with different thought leaders, activists, advocates, filmmakers, book authors, scientists, and more about all of the different facets of the decisions and choices and happenings in our world that affect the well-being of ourselves and all species on Earth. I'm really delighted to have with us on today's show someone with whom I've worked in the past and whose work is just I've long admired. It's Tanyette Colone, and we actually met working on the board of a fractivist organization many years back. And have had the opportunity to kind of collaborate on a few things since then. And I've watched what Tanyette has been doing, and it's really incredible. She's a filmmaker and is currently working on a documentary film called Land of the Midnight Sun. And she also has played a very unique role in bringing the word of divestment and the fact of divestment from the Dakota Access Pipeline internationally. Tanyette is a senior internet marketing consultant at Reach Local, a Gannett company, and Google partner. And in that capacity, she's kind of an incredible social media maven and whiz. She's the founder of WeMust.com, a media platform relaunching in June 2017 that's dedicated to educating women on environmentally toxic energy extraction, healthy living choices, travel, and more. In addition to her documentary, Tanyette did something rather extraordinary this last year. After 7 years of laying the groundwork of relationships and organizational contacts and networks in Norway, where she has family, she was in a unique position to help move our world to a renewable energy future by laying the pathway for a group of indigenous water protectresses from Standing Rock to speak directly to people in powerful positions in Norway to help in the divestment from the Dakota Access Pipeline. And obviously, ever since about, you know, and ever since the summer of 2016, I have repeatedly done programs on Standing Rock, talked to people who've come back from Standing Rock, and talked about the whole issue of taking our understanding of our drive for renewable energy to a further level through understanding the issues at stake with the Dakota Access Pipeline and what all of our options are to, you know, to be aware and conscious and participate in changes that will help save our climate and protect life on Earth. So I'm really thrilled to go back to our Standing Rock theme today in talking with our guest, Tanyette Colone. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Tanyette.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me today.
So, you know, you have a really interesting background because you're basically, you know, a lot of us have been kind of drawn into social media activism as activists, but you're actually both a professional in that field and an activist in that field, and it's a really terrific and unique combination. You know, how did your activism as a water protectress yourself come about?
It came about 8 years ago. I mean, I was always raised, my parents were always active in social issues, especially my father, so I was always raised to be brave to raise your voice on issues that we may personally care about and always to give back to communities. But about a little over 8 years ago, we bought a cute little quintessential farmhouse in an area called Damascus, Pennsylvania. What we didn't know prior to purchasing is that area was already potentially slated for natural gas extraction in Pennsylvania, and there were already other parts of Pennsylvania 3 hours away, 2 hours away, that had already been exposed to it. How the whole Norway situation came about was there was a place called Bradford County, Pennsylvania, 3 hours out, and I have family in Norway and had realized that Norway's state-owned oil company, Statoil, had entered a partnership with Chesapeake at the time. And
Chesapeake
they were drilling
gas,
and that,
we're talking it, about, which is the
yeah, Chesapeake.
I think the company has since gone bankrupt. But
yeah.
Back at the time that you're talking about, Chesapeake Gas was really the initiating entrepreneurial company that was launching the boom in so-called natural gas, fracked gas. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And they were known to be more aggressive, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was kind of shocked by that partnership, knowing Norway just historically having family there and what their cultural thought process is with nature. And for those who don't know, I mean, Norway is almost 98% powered by hydro, by water. So, and they're very sensitive to nature and to families as well. So the idea that they were sort of close to our backyard, being part of this, to me felt like it just was hypocritical at one, and number two, I felt like the people of Norway should know about it. But at that time, there was already rumblings of water contaminations with families that were near that partnership project between, Norway and Chesapeake. So, and I happened to be going to Norway like a few weeks to visit family during the time that I found this out. So I just became, I don't know, something just a little voice that just start making phone calls and try to see if you can leverage this so-called vacation that you're going on to try to get the word out there and start educating Norwegian citizens on what was happening here in the U.S. And I think a lot of people ask why Norway, right? Because it's this non-assuming, beautiful little fairy tale country that's really politically correct, is almost the U.N. in many ways. It doesn't pick sides. It tries to look at, world issues from a from the middle perspective, but what people don't understand is that their oil company, that oil feeds into what's called an oil fund. It's called the oil fund. And that oil fund, from the time that I started following the story 7 or 8 years ago to today, surpassed the Saudi oil fund about 5 years ago as the wealthiest fund in the entire world. And that's what funds a lot of, that's what funds a lot of Norway's social programs. The people live off of this fund. So the elephant in the room for me has always and to this day is still the fact that the people own over 60% of Statoil. It's an oil production company, primarily oil, and they do gas. They're very much in the Bakken right now and have been for several years. And they're producing themselves. So there's no partnership there. They actually, Statoil has an office in Williston, North Dakota, that I was able to see on a trip there this past February, and they have, oil pads outside of Williston, and I was able to visit some of their projects there. So it's a difficult conversation for Norwegians because, one, the people themselves want nothing to do with this. They don't want to know that the money that they're living, that they essentially live off of, is actually causing havoc in other parts of the world. It just goes against what they believe in. They don't want any part of this. They just want to live peacefully. But at the end of the day, they are financing some of the havoc that is happening and has been happening in the U.S. And the reality is that, then you start digging in further, which is how the story fast forwards to today with DAPL and other infrastructure that they've been invested in. If you don't have an oil company that's producing oil or gas, then there is a need to basically finance the infrastructure. The problem is that they do have an oil company that's north of where DAPL is that is producing, so they need to be able to transport it, and transporting by train economically doesn't make sense. So this is the sort of the what they're faced with over there and sort of having to try to educate. And there's so many groups now. It's like day and night. When I started the conversation 8 years ago, they were more concerned about the tar sands project, which that oil was producing, was part of in Alberta, Canada, and you had heads of tribes coming there and having discussions to educate groups. When I came in to talk about Pennsylvania, it was still fairly new, and we were able to get a lot of news coverage over there. It actually became a national story. Why was this woman here talking about fracking and water contamination, and I was able to team up with a Norwegian reporter that was based out of New York, and he helped to cover like a 3-page investigative report, which set off a whole like media flurry back then. So since then, I mean, the groups are like day and night. They've really been pushing Set Oil, the government fund that's invested in some of these infrastructure projects, some of their private banks, public banks, to make them realize that there is a consequence to this investment, because for so long they've been able to sort of hide behind this little fairy tale bubble that they live in. But now people are going over there to expose what these finances, what their financial money is actually funding. So that was sort of the catalyst that brought the women there. So it was many years of just being on the ground. And then I had been out of being an activist on this issue for the last couple of years, still following Norway's investments. And it wasn't until November that I realized that DNB Bank, which is one of their biggest banks of all of Norway, it is like the Norwegian bank, was getting a lot of criticism, and it had just pulled out their stock in their investment in Dapple. And they were one of the biggest investors, which I didn't realize to that point. So that kind of, I just had a calling again, similar to what I had 8 years prior, to say, okay, it's time for you now to get back into this and start leveraging your context how you can. And I needed to also go to Standing Rock to just reconnect with everything that was happening with all of these issues. So
let me ask you a question. So you had this incredible background in Norway. You really understood the dilemma. And it's also it's the same dilemma that we have in all the civilized countries, which is, you know, we're trying to move in a certain direction, or, you know, the planet will be cooked, but our existing infrastructures and therefore, you know, all of our sources of energy are still kind of tied up with this old system, which has, you know, developed a life of its own and, you know, keeps charging forward. And so, you know, on the one hand, we really have to, I love this story because, you know, on the one hand, I mean, here you have the environmentally conscious and conscientious Norwegians, and on the other hand, they're subsisting off of this toxic energy that hurts both the planet and the, you know, particular locale where it's harvested, transported through, shipped from, et cetera. So, you know, we have the sort of global picture on it. We have the local picture on it. And then there's also the international investment picture on it. And you know, the situation of Norway is also the case for us in this country, in that those of us who are seeking, you know, to kind of preserve the ability for the Earth to serve as a habitat for life forms are at the same time, you know, in a sense, trapped in the current infrastructure use and our own needs, you know, for the energy that is now available, which is the wrong form of energy. So, you know, I just want to, you know, frame the story that way, because it's something, you know, we're all living with that dilemma and that dichotomy, and, you know, so it's not about blame, it's about a process,
no.
A process of making a change and coming to awareness, and the same process that you, through your connections and familiarity and concern with, you know, the dichotomy in Norway, I mean, it also parallels what we have here, and I like talking about that because we're all in that dilemma. And so it's not about, you know, demonizing anyone, but, you know, about engaging in a process that moves us in the right direction, which, you know, in your story is like, you know, just a perfect example of that. So, you know, let's move now to, you know, talking about you actually were able to go to Standing Rock. So let's just shift gears for a moment from this story, and we'll kind of hold the arc from it and just share with you know, me and our listeners, what was it like being at Standing Rock? You know, paint a picture for us if you can.
So I was probably going to Standing Rock at the point that most people who had already been there once, twice, or three times, at the lowest point. So this was right before they were going to end camp. I went like the beginning of February, brutal cold, by the way, although the day I was leaving, it went up to 60 degrees somehow. talk that up to climate change, but which is rare for the middle of February. But it was supposed to be one of the lowest times. Like, morale was down. You had the people who were there helping to clean up, and all the news was really focusing on was what a total, apparently how much garbage was left behind. I actually was impressed when I arrived there for the first time, because for the amount of people that technically went through Standing Rock, at one point I think it was more than the population of one of the biggest cities in North Dakota went through there. I was actually impressed to see, like, how little left there was to clean, and how dedicated the people that were there were to getting that whole camp cleaned and making sure that donations were going to local schools and that nothing was going to waste. But what I, even though people had the rumblings of saying that it was supposed to be a downtime, what I saw there was so much hope, so much beauty in the youth that is coming up in our country. And, you know, especially with this new presidency where there's just been so much negativity just in general in the news, I left with it. We as a country, like at the core, are an incredible country. I met like a 20-something-year-old that had just recently graduated college, was a solar engineering whiz, and had figured out how to create a solar grid out of like MacGyver, so to speak, a solar grid while they were there so that these tents could stay warm. I was just blown away by the young women and men that were dedicated there daily, like making sure that they were basically axing through ice to get to things to clean up. There were no shortage of stories of beautiful people from all walks of life of what had brought them there, from all different age brackets. Some were tear-jerking to a certain degree. But I left with a lot of hope, not with distress. And I was glad I was able to connect with the land and why they were fighting for. And that land obviously has a lot of history, historical battles in many ways that came full circle yet again in today's day and age. But I left with hope. And for me, it was important to anchor myself there because, I had been out of the fight for a couple of years due to personal reasons. So in order to reengage, I felt like I needed to anchor myself so fully to what that was. But what I didn't know is that trip would actually create a domino effect on the trip to Norway that would happen like less than 6 weeks later.
Mm-hmm.
So it was with communicating with one of the women, Michelle Cook, who went on the trip. She's an indigenous rights attorney, and she was the one that was intricate in putting together the report that ended up in DNB Bank back in November that caused them to initially pull their stock, but they still had the heavy-duty loan until we arrived on that trip that just happened in late March. So I think what people needed to understand is that there was a lot of hope there. There were incredible people, and our country, there isn't despair here. We have like a great future to build off of. There is some great young people coming through the ranks. And again, it was people of all ages there, and they all had different reasons for why they were called there. So each individual story of the water protectors in itself was just beautiful. That's why they were there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. And so, you know, as you circulated around and met different people, you know, how did that all, what was the atmosphere like? Because one of the things that you've shared is that you met up with people who later formed the group that traveled to Norway together. How did all of that come about?
So I didn't really physically meet a lot of the women that ended up going on this trip.
Mm-hmm.
I had a conversation prior to going to North Dakota, and I had just missed Michelle. She was leaving the day I was arriving, but we had connected on a call about her report. She did a human rights violation report that ended up at the DNB Bank meeting back in November of 2016. That was the intricate report that caused them to dump the stock in the project initially. So they had stock, and then they had loans, and then they have the credit line. So they, you know, dumping stock from a financial perspective is always easier, but this report showed what the violations were on the ground, and it was hard for DNB to argue those points that were there. So that was the sort of the first point or rock to hit them where they were like, okay, well, we'll dump the stock. And it also caused them to do their own independent. They hired an outside human rights firm to do their own independent study as to whether or not they were going to dump the loan and not renew the credit line that they had for energy transfer partners. But I had made mm-hmm. a call to her prior to going, hoping I could meet her while I was in North Dakota, and we had a conversation about Norway. I think she was already thinking about Norway in a sense. I don't think she understood the whole why Norway. Like, a lot of people don't understand how the sequence, how they're set up over there, unless you've lived there or know people from there. But she felt like it was unsettled, like there was still more work to be done related to Norway and even on a global sense. So she was already getting that calling to do something. I explained to her how I had been to Norway several years before and had made contact, and how much, in many ways, what people don't realize is they hear Norway as being this socialist system, right? And socialist people confuse as communism in many ways. And so a socialist country is even, that's a broad term. But this small country actually has more level of democracy when we really look at it than we do here in the United States of America, because nowhere else in the world could someone like me, I'm not a celebrity, pick up the phone and end up having conversations with members of parliament with open mm-hmm. arms, with the desire to have human engagement, or with the big banking institutes, which is what happened when we were there. I mean, I just can't think of anywhere, not even here. I mean, we have a hard enough time because of all the different layers of people you have to go through to get to the person at the top. They don't have that there. They're still there's a level of innocence there that allows for common human engagement without there being any skepticism revolving it. So I told her that, and then, you know, planted a seed. She already had that seed within her to do something, and she teamed up with Osprey from We Can International, and it just came. It was one of those synchronicities that you just know when you're in it, because I had it happen on my first trip there. You can't, when you're in that synchronicity, you just go with where that journey is going, and you sort of surrender to it, knowing that you are playing a part in it and you're doing forward action. But when you're in that journey and in that zone, there's all the doors just blow completely open. And that's what this trip was. We barely knew each other. A couple of the women knew each other from Standing Rock. A couple weren't from Standing Rock. They were from other nations. Michelle and Autumn are from the Navajo Nation, but they all had been to Standing Rock. They had all witnessed. They had been arrested and had witnessed dog attacks on women, you name it. I mean, some of the things that happened on the ground there had me in tears to hear about. I was embarrassed, you know, that our country that is admired by so many people around the globe was doing that to their own people. And then I think for countries like Norway that were investing this, again, that fairy tale bubble they lived in, even for DNB Bank, they were shocked in knowing that the United States of America would put a military state against their own people. So I think in many ways they always thought, how could this actually be happening? It's the United States of America. It sounds like a third world country. Even when we were talking 8 years ago when Obama was in office, and people, I was telling them, there are actual people in Pennsylvania that don't have access to clean water. For them, it was just shocking. They're like, don't you have regulations in place to protect you? How it almost sounds like a third world country. And I was like, you're right, it is. We have essentially turned our rural areas into resource colonies. So, I mean, I guess the moral of the story is never assume that people sitting in these ivory towers actually know what's happening on the ground, and that any individual has the power to leverage their most powerful resource, which I think is your voice. So I know people are always asking, what can I do? And I think it's just leveraging your contacts, leveraging your voice, whatever your belief is that you're passionate in, and just going for it. I mean, the worst that can happen is you get nowhere. The best is situations like this, where a small group of people, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, are disrupting and having human engagement and dialogue directly to the people that are making these decisions. So that doesn't only impact them pulling out of DAPL, but it impacts the way they're going to look at going into any potential pipeline project in the future, which is what was some of the feedback I just received from sources that are within DNB recently on this last trip when I was there. They said they're almost scared to ever touch one of those projects again, because in their world, from a financial perspective, they checked all the boxes on, okay, yeah, they have these regulations, okay, X question, you know, XXX, minus they didn't go, you know, they didn't physically, prior to investing, really take a look at what were the laws for that state, et cetera. So, well, and they weren't excusing themselves either.
I think it's a, you know, it's a massive, you know, sea change to be able to educate these people. So could you just kind of describe who went to Norway, when you went, and, you know, who you, not the individuals, but what organizations you, you know, you met with, how you were received, and, you know, the kind of response that you got from the Norwegian people, both in these organizations that were supporting this, as well as the general public, when you went there?
I was so proud. I mean, again, Norway has always felt like a second home to me because my family's been there for 30-plus years. It was, they were welcomed with the red carpet. The women who went was Washtaway Wynn Young, who is, she's Phyllis Young's daughter, and she's from the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. There was Sarah Jumping Eagle, who's from Standing Rock, a physician, and had been part of the medic group for the camps over there. And then there was Michelle Cook, who's an indigenous rights attorney. There was Tara Huska, who's also an indigenous rights attorney, and she's very well known in D.C. and has been in media here in the U.S. And then there was Autumn Chacon, who is an artist and an activist as well, and she had been at Standing Rock. And then there was Osprey, Oriel Lake, who knew Michelle, that's how they connected, who runs We Can International, that has dedicated, you know, since its inception, a lot of all the premise of their work is empowering indigenous women's voices across the globe. We all didn't really know each other. I mean, this came together rather quickly. My main goal was to leverage my whatever contacts I had there, and even if I didn't have them, to get on the phone to get them and get these meetings going. And then Osprey did a lot with obviously bringing the women together with Michelle's guidance, and then fundraising to get the women there in a short period of time. Mind you, we did this in like 4 weeks or less. From the initial conversation I had with Michelle to, oh my goodness, we're booking tickets like a week before we're leaving. And a lot of the meetings took a little bit to get. I was able to get the meeting directly with the Wealth Fund. We were able to get meetings with members of Parliament. I was able to get a meeting with DNB Bank. That one took a little bit longer, but some of my connections with Greenpeace allowed to make it so that they solidified the meeting. We had a couple of public events as well. They were all over major media. The groups were, I mean, beside themselves, because for so long they've been fighting this. They've been fighting Standing Rock. They've been fighting, they were fighting tar sands. They were fighting what's happening in the Bakken. So to have the women actually take the trip over there, they were honored. So they took care of them like I just can't even describe. I think it was healing. I can only speak for my perception of it. I'm not speaking for them, but I think in many ways it was a healing journey for them to be able to lift their voices and speak to what actually happened on the ground there. It was a very powerful spiritual trip that then ended up, like, because of it, they ended up in Switzerland meeting with Credit Suisse Bank and UBS Bank as well. So there was a little side trip that spun off because of it. But they were very powerful, strong women. I don't know what else, what other information you would need, because you had everything you needed in that room related to what was happening, whether it was from a medical perspective or from a psychology perspective, you know, the post-traumatic stress syndrome that goes with that, the violations that took place. And in many ways, it was genocide against their people. And I know that some people might be taken aback by that, but that when you look at the true definition of what was happening there, in many ways it has been for them. So it was a very powerful trip. The Norwegian people themselves were just surrounded them with so much love. And they're fired up because as of today, the Wealth Fund is still heavily invested in DAPL. So DNB Bank did pull out while we were there. I mean, my sources say we were the last straw. They were already on the fence about it and were trying to unload the loan for the last few months, which does take a little bit longer. But, you know, we received a call when we arrived there. I had a call on that Sunday basically stating that they were pulling out, but they still had the meeting with the women, and they're taking a lot into consideration with what was stated there. because some of them were parents and they were just appalled by the stories that the women were telling them.
Mhm. Mhm. Wow. So what kind of stories did they tell? And, you know, some of the listeners here on Connect the Dots, you know, may be aware of the kinds of things that were happening at Standing Rock and may be unaware of others. One of the things recently is that there's been a wonderful film made by a trio of documentary filmmakers called Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock. And there are three co-directors. It's, you know, a co-production with Native Americans. One of the directors is Myron Dewey. Josh Fox, the director of Gasland and How to Let Go and Love the World, a climate action movie, as well as James Spione are the three directors. And I recently was able to screen the film before a group of, you know, mixed Americans and Native Americans. And it's just a very powerful documentary presentation of some of the things that, you know, went down at Standing Rock that are being done in our name. And, you know, I just also want to parenthetically say that, you know, both you and I, Tanya, will be on a panel with two of the filmmakers on Martha's Vineyard coming up over Memorial Day weekend on May 28th at the Martha's Vineyard Film Center as part of an environmental film festival. That Sunday, May 28th at 4 p.m., Awake, A Dream of Standing Rock will be shown and will be on a panel following the screening with two of the filmmakers, Myron Dewey and James Spione, and the third, Josh Fox, we hope will be present on Skype. And we'll be talking about, you know, after people will have had an opportunity to see through the film some of the things that occurred at Standing Rock. It's very moving. We'll be talking about that on that Sunday. And anyone in the region, please do come and join us. But right now on this program, on our Connect the Dots show today, we want to kind of give a word picture of some of the things, you know, that happened at Standing Rock, which, you know, some listeners may not be aware of, that the women water protectresses with whom you traveled to Norway shared with the people funding these, you know, the DAPL pipeline, and which resulted in their withdrawing some of that funding. So, you know, we can both kind of talk about that.
So some of the things they talked about, and they actually brought visuals for the meetings, were like the dog attacks specifically towards women that were just innocently trying to protect their water, and having the dogs attack them directly on like their chest and their neck. And she had pictures of this scene, which is just was disgusting. Stories about people being
arrested. Before we go into that, let's just, you know, briefly kind of set a little bit of a context, which is that, you know, without due consultation, the DAPL pipeline was rerouted from other areas of North Dakota and sent through the regions that are native tribal lands. And because these pipelines always leak, they specifically were being sent through a river with a potential for leakage. And in fact, the pipeline is already leaking now, even though it isn't even active yet. And there have been repeated leaks and spills, and these pipelines always break, leak, and spill. It's just the nature of concrete carrying these noxious substances. And so, you know, there is great and rightful concern over, you know, water contamination with the, you know, through the native water supply, through the native lands, without due consultation, without an environmental study. And so the whole context of the Standing Rock gathering was for, you know, the Standing Rock Sioux tribe and its various indigenous allies from around the country, joined by people of all stripes, to be in prayerful, you know, ceremony and quiet protest, unarmed, unaggressive, no shouting, you know, which is the native style of taking action, to, you know, hold their own ground and land in a plea for this pipeline not to come in by corporate interests and, you know, destroy their water, basically.
Correct.
So that's the context. And in that context, dogs were unleashed, attack dogs.
Correct.
Brought in by mercenary groups and police were unleashed to attack people as they prayed. So, you know,
correct.
Yeah, so that's the context. So, and as you're stating, they also attacked women. They, you know, they didn't, old people, they didn't, like, hold back and say, you
they
know.
Didn't hold back.
Yeah, they let them loose,
actually. They didn't hold back at all. Yeah, they let them loose. It was disgusting. I mean, the dog attacks were traumatizing visuals to see. There were cases when people were arrested towards the beginning of this year in the brutal cold winter of North Dakota. They were put into buses. They were tied with, like, plastic zip ties, put into buses that they basically hiked up the air conditioning further in, like, zero below or, you know, five-degree weather to the point that the zip ties were breaking and people were having to go on themselves because it was that cold. And they were put into these cold, like, dog tents with signs, which just it was a lot of psychological warfare that took place there too, to basically make the whole process feel demeaning, and they were stripped of their normal, like, human rights and dignity by the way it took place. So there was a psychological component with it as well that was equally just disgusting, that repeats itself throughout history. And here we were in our modern day age using those same, like, filthy tactics against our own citizens who were just have a right to peacefully protect what is there. So it was a lot of stories, repeated stories like that, like in the middle of the cold, water cannons being blasted and rubber bullets being thrown into crowds, where one woman actually from New York, I can't think of her name, I think her first name is Sophia, but she had her arm almost completely blown off because of this. So it was just multiple cases like that for people who were just peacefully trying to protect their most valuable resource, which is their water supply, and for very good reasons. So, I mean, there wasn't a dry eye in those rooms. We had the president of the Sami Parliament, which the Samis are an indigenous group in Scandinavia, and they have been fighting the wealth fund, and of course they were petitioning to be to pull out of these projects or whatever. And she was in one of the meetings. She was in the wealth fund meeting, the government oil fund meeting with us. And there wasn't a dry eye in the room when you would hear these women speak and the passion and just the oppression that their people just historically have been through. And this was just another repeat in history for them.
Mm-hmm.
It was powerful. It was powerful. And I think for them, for a lot of the people who were sitting on the other side of the investment portion of it, I think there was some embarrassment, and it was hard for them to take because they had to witness it. It wasn't no longer a Facebook post or a video. It was these women that had lived it. This is their home for many of them, and they saw the atrocities that took place there during that time period. So it becomes a little bit harder to ignore. And there's a lot of people don't know, but there's a lot of history ironically, in North Dakota with Norway. A lot of Norwegians migrated over there in the late 1800s, and the Bakken is actually a Norwegian for the hill. So that whole Bakken region is a Norwegian.
Really?
It's a Norwegian word. So there's a lot of just historical ties that bring Norway into that space as well, which kind of adds to the whole storyline.
That's amazing, really. I mean, that is truly, truly amazing that that connection exists. So, you know, if they wanted to look away, they really can't because of they're historically wedded to the situation. And it is hard to look at. It is hard to, you know, and there is a kind of sense of wanting to look away. I mean, it's a very, very disturbing thing. When I was watching awake, a dream from Standing Rock with this mixed group, as I described, you know, one woman who'd been a very lovely and well-intentioned woman who'd been was learning of this for the first time, said, oh my, someone should have called the governor of North Dakota, you know. And of course, people who've been, you're laughing, right? I was just about to say, people who have been following what went on there laughed. I mean, because we know that it was the governor and, you know, of Norway that hired these mercenary military people to protect the corporate infrastructure from the people who live in the region, and that it has come that far in the United States, and yet here was someone used to, you know, a more benevolent idea that we should be able to turn to our government for protection, you know, shocked and appalled that this is going on. And, of course, the news media doesn't really cover it very well. Very few people know about
it.
Except,
they don't.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just very on the surface level. And I think when you look at the list of banks that were actually invested in that project, a big portion of it was foreign dollars. And I can't think of anything more un-American than having foreign dollars dictate how we treat American citizens. It's just, to me, it's just mind-boggling. But again, for a lot of these foreign banks, they can sit in their ivory tower. They're disconnected because, again, they have their checks and balances on what they look at as to what is going to be a kind of project that's not going to be controversial and should be profitable. And when they go in, it should be profitable, except it's not when you, because it's not, it's really, they're never profitable. It's always based on whatever community is going to is the sacrificial lamb. And I think what this whole DAPL situation, why it had ripples across the world is because of the amount of people that came to it. And there were echoes of cries everywhere in every country in the world that wanted out of that project. And I really think it changes the scope of conversation for future projects, which is also, I think, a good takeaway of this whole thing. It's not only about stopping it there, clearly, but it also can help future communities in other places in the world that we may never even know exist at this current point. So, you know, it's very important to get out there. I mean, I think the biggest takeaway outside of using your voice is, if you're going to have a strong opinion about issues that are happening near you, around you, my biggest advice is always take the time to get on the ground and see it and witness it for yourself. Not what the news is telling you, not what your best friend is telling you, but if it's really that important to you and you really have that strong of an opinion on it, get on the ground and witness it for yourself.
Well, you know, the whole thing is, you know, what we do on Connect the Dots is all of these events are happening in this community and that community, you know, and each community is fighting on their own, and it's just a local story, and the national news won't cover it, you know, because it's just affecting one locality. But if you zoom back on the map and look at all of these pipeline infrastructures where they are running through multiple communities and, you know, millions of people all over the country, further all over the world. I mean, you and I originally connected around a local community that was experiencing the, you know, this threat, this problem. But, you know, community by community by community, and they will give it, each community a different name to this segment of a pipeline. I've covered other things in New York and in Westchester on this show. And, you know, you lose the big picture, which is that it's happening everywhere in all these communities, and it's left to be considered just a problem, you know, in one community after another, and we don't connect the dots, you know, so.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
And know that we're all interconnected 100%, that today is Standing Rock, tomorrow is something else. You know, we have the 9/11 first responders, it's a farmer, it's someone of Norwegian descent that I spoke to, you know, that's north of Williston that had a pipeline go through her land that was partially funded by the Wealth Fund of Norway. I mean, there's no shortage of stories, but I think having dialogue, less about villainizing, more about giving the benefit of the doubt to open those conversations, I think is where we start shifting more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think outside here, too, if we're not getting the answers we want here, Norway can actually be used as the model to continue to have these conversations in every other country, including Canada, which, as much as we all love Justin Trudeau, I mean, he's, in my opinion, conversations and more pressure needs to be had on these topics over there as well, since they're our friendly neighbor. And some of that infrastructure is coming from that. The need is coming from there into our backyard. So I think those are conversations that should be had. And I know he hasn't been so open to having them in recent times. But
We have a lot of people listening to this show from Canada, following postings that, you know, I do on Facebook from Canada, and who are also have been, you know, sounding the alarm and are also very concerned about this, because, you know, if you've got a whole infrastructure that's going through millions of miles, to have to go through and stop a quarter inch of it in one place or one location, it's productive in that it's not going through, but it's a much harder way to fight the battle. And all the people that are fighting that battle need to connect with each other and understand that, you know, if we fight it in one place or if we fight it in the big picture, we're helping people everywhere.
100%.
And, you know, yeah, and there are, you know, renewable energy options and alternatives. And, you know, so we don't have to feel like, oh, I'm going to be stranded alone without a way to fuel my car, which is, you know, or heat my home, if we don't go for this, you know. There are a lot of other options. And so, you know, that's one of the things, too, to understand. And you know, there have been people putting that together. Yeah. So we can make a better choice.
No, 100%. But as long as we have foreign interest dollars coming into our country where they can exploit those resources, that the longer we're handcuffed to a dying fuel source. So we can have Norway's CEO of their oil company more recently, I think in March, came out stating that he had no plans of leaving oil and gas here in the U.S., even though it has been profitable for them until recently. As long as they're here, we're still going to have the problem with infrastructure, right, because they still need to support transportation. And while they're becoming almost 100% sustainable, getting rid of diesel vehicles in the next few years and going straight to electric because they're a smaller population, right, so they can get away with that, we're just going to fall behind. So there is, you know, there's pieces to this puzzle on a global scale that we all have to take a look at and put pressure on, because when you can go in front of the oil fund of Norway, that's the biggest in the world and is basically has a piece of every big company, global company in the world, they make one change. When they made one change in their legislation related to coal, and they just like Duke Energy and some of those other companies based on ethics on the ground with communities, when they make one change, that has a ripple effect across the globe. So I don't want to, like, undermine it. It's divestment, yes, but we want it to be reinvestment and a more sustainable future, and we want to set the tone on a global scale that they all play a part in this conversation. Just because they're not feeling the pressure because they're almost 100% sustainable doesn't allow them to stay in their fairy tale and slow down what they have a global stage to fast track and move us more into a renewable future. They're one of those countries, and there's a lot of countries now that are going to be fighting for that space to be the ones that are innovating in regards to sustainable energy. So there's going to be a race for that. It's up to us as America. I mean, again, when I was in Sandy Rock, shocked by with so much hope with the innovation in our youth and our American citizens, there's no reason why we can't be leading in that regard. I mean, we have some brilliant minds in this country, but we're going to be handcuffed unless we start really getting on the ground and having strong conversations with decision makers to say, we don't want this anymore. It's time. The time is now. It's not 4 years from now. It's not 5 years. We don't have the time. The time to have this dialogue is today. And I think it starts with dialogue. We need to get in front of these decision makers and have real conversations and not just assume that they know that every single detail that's happening on the ground, because a lot of times they just don't. So anyway.
Yeah, you know, and that's kind of considered a no-no, or people feel they don't have access. But, you know, there are, I think, ways that access can be brought about. And if it happens once, it can happen again, you know, somewhere. And, you know, we have to kind of help make it happen. That's what all of this is about. And the thing is, you know, I think it's also an important lesson to people. You, by virtue of family and other contacts, had these relationships. We all have to think about the relationships or the access that we each have. Because if we just kind of go along with the program of business as usual, rather than, you know, kind of looking at, well, who could I talk to? How could I help? You know, instead of going, oh, well, you know, my relative, my friend is involved in this sector, in this business, and business is business, and that's their personal business. This is, and, you know, I couldn't say anything about that. This is everyone's business. The future of whether, you know, the children will have a planet to live on, and the animals and food plants and everything that we've taken for granted and benefited from the earth will be here, and the clean water supply and all the rest of it. We can't disassociate and give somebody a pass because that's his business and that's his choice, because that person's work, their personal decision, their investment is all either moving toward what's going to work for life on Earth, or, you know, sustaining what we've done in the past because we didn't think we could change, but that is undermining it with every passing day. And that's how we have to look at it and have these courageous conversations, even though it obviously, it isn't easy to have them. I think you, in addition to your courage, your following, your inspiration, and all that you've done, I think you're a kind of role model of, you know, you don't go and scream in someone's face or insult them. There's a way of having a conversation, from a place of heart with people who are also going to be, and they and their descendants will be suffering the ill effects of all of this, and maybe they were not aware of it.
I don't think sometimes they know to what degree it's taking place. That's not to say there aren't bad people in the world or people who just don't give to flying, you know, whatevers. But I think fundamentally the core of humans, we don't want to know we're hurting people over time. And I think that becomes harder to ignore when you have someone having human dialogue in front of you saying, well, it did, and here's why. And then this is not profitable anyway. I spoke to a Norwegian economist before I left that trip with the women, and he's well known in Norway. And he said, like, their oil fund, if you isolate the oil fund, right, you know, look at the books for that oil or the public banks or anything, you know, the fund looks like, oh, it's diversified, great, it's making a fabulous return. If you put together that it's an oil nation and you look at the books collectively as an entire ecosystem, Norway is actually overexposed in oil and gas projects around the world. So they're at 10%. Wow. The global market is only at 5%. And this report came out actually, it was a Greenpeace report with this economist that I spoke to, and it's, you know, the global market's only 5%. Norway's at 10%. That really actually puts them at an overexposure level that's scary if I'm a citizen of the country. So there's more work to be done in Norway, but there's more work to be done in Germany. There's more work to be done in Switzerland, which they're a bit more staunch on hearing the messaging, but eventually they'll have to also face the music, because it's not, the story is not going away. I mean, the spirit of Standing Rock is going to continue to have ripples across the world. And I think we're just seeing the beginning of exactly what Josh Fox's, the premise of the film is about, which is that awakening in all of us to get up, wake up, and use whatever we have to do our small part to make a difference.
That's right. And just, you know, reiterating here, we're talking with Tanyette Colone, activist and filmmaker. Tanyette and I will be on a panel on Martha's Vineyard May 28th at 4 p.m., a film screening of Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock. co-directed by Myron Dewey, Josh Fox, and James Spione. It's also playing nationwide in all different venues and places. You can find it online as well to see the film. It's great to see it with people because then more discussion can happen, but it's just great to see it. And I highly recommend that listeners go online to Awake a Dream from Standing Rock and, you know, download and purchase the film. It really places the visual three-dimensional reality to what we're talking about here. And the other facet of it is that Myron Dewey, the Digital Smoke Signals, the wonderful indigenous filmmaker and drone flyer, has captured the three-dimensional reality and the historical reality of the Standing Rock events and everything, so that you really understand the way Native Americans and the indigenous peoples value and see and have the courage and the conviction and the passion and the love and the faith to take a stand for the earth. And I think they're really they're really a model for us in terms of kind of awakening from, our engagement in just the immediate details of our own day-to-day life and responsibilities to the bigger picture and having the courage and conviction to stand up for what counts. Because I think Standing Rock is really a lot about standing up for ourselves, for each other, and for the earth. And actually on that theme, just will mention as well that I've been regularly covering Standing Rock. We have some terrific programs in the Connect the Dots archives, a recent interview with Dina Metzger, people who have been to Standing Rock and talk about these various issues. We're going to have other programs on Standing Rock coming up. So it's just a regular theme, even though that pipeline is, as of yet, still being constructed and the camps have been dispersed. We're going to see Standing Rock-style events all over the country as we need to in order to do the job of earth and water protection that is so urgent in our time. Any parting words, Tonyette, about how people can follow you and your work and see your own upcoming film, which documents the Norway trip as well as other issues concerning this?
Well, we're going to be relaunching our website at we-must.com. It's in the process of being launched at the beginning of June, so they'll be able to follow some of the mini episodes of the documentary, Land of the Midnight Sun. But that would probably be the best way to follow along, and it'll be launching in the next couple weeks, and we'll have articles related to the trip and mini episodes of the upcoming documentary, as well as just other topics related to these types of issues.
Great. Terrific. We must. Well, I think that sums that kind of sums up what we have to do here. We must. We must get involved, take action, be informed, let others know, be aware, and stand for the earth and our all our relations. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots, Tonyette Colon. It's been a pleasure having you here and hearing about your wonderful and highly effective journey. And thank you, listeners, for being with us on this edition of Connect the Dots. We're back. Collect the Dots. We'll be back. We'll be back next Wednesday, as always, 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. If you've liked this program, please like us on iTunes, share us on Facebook and via social media, and follow some of our other programs on the Connect the Dots archives at Connect the Dots Podbeam. If you search that, you'll come right to them. As always, we have our sort of, be well, chin up, keep marching forward, and stand for all our relations. Till next week, I'm Allison Rose Levy.